Good evening, if I could have your attention for a minute. I'd like to welcome everyone to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. How many of you are here at your first Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture? Great. Wonderful to see. I know better Skip than in your case, but...
I forgot.
Great to see all the new faces. Hope you make yourself at home, make some friends. We're a fairly unique organization. We've been doing this for 35 years or so, but entirely on a shoestring. We have no staff, all volunteers, but we do have certain expenses such as printing and internet and that kind of thing, so we do take up a $5 membership fee to kind of defray our expenses going forward. But if you want to be a regular, you can get 6 months for $35, which is about a little over half price, so that's the way to go if you want to become a regular, and we encourage you to become a regular. Our format for the newcomers is we have a lecture for about 45 to 60 minutes or so, and then we try to reserve half an hour for Q&A at the end, so hold your questions till the end, and I'll moderate and recognize the questioners. And might be a little time for kind of mingling at the end, but they try to close the restaurant at 9, so, you know, maybe make friends, you can adjourn to some other watering hole nearby or something to carry on the after conversation. So that's why we encourage people to get here early at 6:30 to eat, so that's kind of our social time, from 6:30 to 7:30. If you didn't get a flyer for the rest of the schedule for the spring, be sure to pick one up from Dr. Alkeck over there. And if you didn't get a chance to pay your admission fee coming in, see Dr. Alkeck on the way out.
He did, though.
And the bill for the food is between you and L. Phoenix, but make sure you take care of that before you walk out, because we get tagged for it if you don't, and we prefer not to pick up that expense. And, of course, be generous to your wait staff. They work hard. We're doing the Philosopher's Jeopardy event again this year, for those of you that might have been last year. But rather than doing it as a summer event, we're doing it in the fourth Tuesday of Thursday slot. But it will be back at the Unity Church of Dallas Fellowship Hall. Fourth Tuesday of May, that would be, which would be May 26th, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And there's a flyer on that, too, to pick up. And we are giving cash prizes away to our three college teams. So if you feel inclined to, you know, make a donation in support of those prizes, we will welcome it. And we are a 501c3 organization, so you can write it off on your tax returns if you're charitably inclined in that direction. So I think that's kind of all of our business for the evening, except that I learned just a couple minutes ago that one of our regulars, Bob Radford, that I'm sure a lot of you know, is not in good health condition. And his friend Jerry has written a poem about that, and I'm going to give Jerry the opportunity here to share the poetry with us.
All right. I've known Bob for 5-6 years. We go to the YMCA together. We go to some classes together. He's spoken here, I've spoken here, but he is not doing too well. And so I write kind of corny poetry, and I'll get it to him, and I'm just going to, as somebody suggested, reading it. And then if you feel free to sign it, just do so. I'll get it to him tomorrow. Now, his name is Bob Radford. To the proper Professor Radford, who propagates philosophical priorities, may his professioning prompt proprieties. Are you Bob, Robert, or Bobby? We want to address you properly. Are you in a man, a mon, a Ram, a Lama Dali? Professor Radford is properly praised. Maybe you didn't notice last time when one of his students spoke. who he had in college class in philosophy. Yes, I rode home with Bob, and he was very proud of this student, and maybe you didn't notice. The speaker just gave Bob a great big hug. Remember, 40 years ago. Confusion about your last name. Are you Bradford, Crawford, or Granford from the firm of Gifford, Mulford, and Manford? And your citizenship, is it in Kansas or Texas or Oklahoma or Iowa or Minnesota with convictions in Kentucky, where he taught for a while? As a Muslim, he is an imam. As a Hindu, priest in the temple, or a rabbi of Jewish in the Jewish temple, or a cardinal as a Roman Catholic, or a hermit monk as an Iceland, or a basketball coach for Oklahoma State. Your existence is still a mystery. You're a Baylor Bear and a Texas Longhorn. Now, as a traitor, you have become an Okie. Now, altogether, this is enlightening. We want nothing left to be missing. Now, better to claim you are ripening. It's a favorite term I have for older people. We're ripening.
Thank you.
We wish the best to you to get better. Good is good, but better is better. We know you as a keeper. So, let me circulate. Now, I have two different forms. One, the wise men and wise women would work out.
Thank you.
And the other is from a class last night. Then, if I may make one invitation. Bob has been in charge of this group. Some of you have come to a science and religion group that meets once a month. Well, he and others have helped arrange Brian Tinsley, who is a professor emeritus of physics from the University of Texas at Dallas, who will discuss science and religion of climate change. So that's next Tuesday.
All right, so I encourage you to sign the card as it goes around if you're so inclined. So on to the feature of the evening. It's our privilege at Dallas Philosophers Forum to welcome back to the forum Dr. Robert Hunt from SMU's Perkins School of Theology. I can say I've had the pleasure of knowing Robert since we were both in seventh grade at Richardson Junior High School, not too far from where we are right now. And Robert and his twin brother came in from Galveston and broke into our little clique that had been together since kindergarten. It didn't take very long for me to figure out that Robert and I had a lot of things in common and became a very good friend to the point that when we graduated from high school and both went to University of Texas, we were roommates for a year there at University of Texas. And we were known for the vigor of our intellectual discussions and arguments, and to the point that we literally had a piece of notebook paper taped to the wall that was the argument list. It was the list of the subjects that had been argued. And I think if I dug enough around, I think I still got that somewhere. It may take me a while to put my hand on it, but I think I do still possess that document. Whereas I went on to law school, Robert went to the divinity track. It's now become divine. graduating from Perkins School of Theology, and then on his ordination, he went to Malaysia spent quite a bit of time over in that part of the world, and then somehow managed to get a gig being paid by the Austrian government to promote Methodism in Austria. I'm still not quite sure how that was arranged, but that's what I'm led to understand. But he currently is on the faculty of SMU Perkins School of Law. You might have seen him quoted in the paper. He's become an expert on interreligious dialogue, particularly the dialogue with Islam, which has been much in the paper today as a result of his spending so much time in an Islamic-dominated culture. So I will introduce you to Dr. Robert Hunt.
I don't want my margarita to get watered down while I'm talking. Okay, thank you very much. It's good to be here. I have a lot of things I could say about David, but we kind of have a mutually assured destruction pact, and it's just better if we leave that where it was. The invitation for me to come and talk to you all was one that was gracious enough to really let me decide what I wanted to talk about. And so what I suggested was some reading I've been doing recently based on the work of Alain Graham and in particular Charles Taylor, but also a number of others, relating to secularity, secularism, and what is called public theology. Now, let me just ask by show of hands, how many people are familiar at least a little bit with Charles Taylor's, who's familiar with Charles Taylor, anybody? Okay, yeah. And his latest book called A Secular Age?
Maybe a little bit.
Haven't read it yet, okay. It's 800 pages long. But Taylor, the good thing about Charles Taylor is that he's an enormously circular writer. So the reason it's so long is because every chapter he comes back in the first half of the chapter is a reminder of what he said in the last chapter, right? So it turns out it's not that hard a book to read. But it has some real insights, and these insights will bring us into some matters that are really very contemporary and right here in Dallas, and in fact have to do with some of the work I've done sort of in public commentary related to interreligious dialogue, and in particular the kind of stuff that's coming up even today. As you know, or maybe you don't know, the Texas Senate had a set of hearings on a bill that will prohibit foreign law from entering into U.S. courts. And I had a long debate with a person via my blog about this, because I said, why is this necessary since U.S. courts don't have any foreign law jurisdiction? And she said, well, you don't seem to understand that it codifies that fact. And I said, so are you telling me that the Constitution of the State of Texas and the Constitution of the United States were actually just sort of aspirational for U.S. courts, and they now needed to be codified? Because really the judges didn't have to follow local law until you actually make a local law that says you have to follow local law. Anyway, she and I finally parted company with me saying, I don't think you understand either law or courts and what they do. And she wrote back and said, I don't think you know what danger we are in today. Touché. But we're going to get to that. Let's start with Charles Taylor talking about what it means to say that we live in a secular age. And I will give an apology in advance that when he talks about we, he means what he calls North Atlantic culture. He means the cultural realm that is, roughly speaking, Western Europe, Canada, and the United States. And everywhere else that's touched by that culture. But generally speaking, he's talking about this culture that's around the North Atlantic world. Okay, I've lived in many other places in the world, Malaysia, Singapore, Austria. Most of my life, my adult life, I've actually lived outside the U.S. Many places are touched by the secular age, but he's talking about this world. And he says there are three meanings of secularization in secularization theory. And the first meaning is the secularization of public spaces and the privatization of religious space, pushing religion into private spaces and making sure public spaces are entirely secular. And of course, we've seen this happen in the United States even over the last 30 or 40 years based on the Constitution. Civic organizations and governments can't set up nativity scenes and that sort of thing in public spaces, right? That has to be on a church ground or something like that. So that's the privatization of public space. And by the way, he would also say the secularization of public space in the sense of public discourse. Right? The second thing he says is secularization can mean the gentle decline of belief, religious belief and practice. And that, of course, is true as part of European and American history over the last 200 years at an accelerating pace. Recent Pew Foundation surveys have shown that the number of young people under the age of 35, that seems very young to me now, the number of young people under the age of 35 who say that they have no religious affiliation is now approaching 40% and rising. The number of people in the U.S. overall who say they have no religious affiliation is around 20%. These are unprecedentedly high numbers. And the trend appears entirely in that direction. I can tell you in the theology school, this is not a good business trend for us. But we're working with it, okay? But the main thing, when Taylor talks about secularization, those other two are simply observable social facts. His real interest is saying that in a secular society, not only do you have a decline in belief, but you have new conditions under which even believers believe. There is a new shape of experience which prompts people to believe differently, and a new context in which all search and questioning about the moral and the spiritual must proceed. Put it more bluntly, nobody who believes in God today believes in God the same way people did 200 years ago. We're in a fundamentally different situation, even for those who are believers. Okay? And I'll quote Taylor, "The main feature of this new context is that it puts an end to the naive acknowledgement of the transcendent or of goals or claims which go beyond the claims of human flourishing. And this is quite unlike religious turnovers in the past, where one naive horizon is substituted for another naive horizon, or where two naive horizons fuse syncretistically, say the conversion of Asia Minor from Christianity to Islam in the wake of the Turkish conquest, where you don't merely have a sort of a shift from a Christian way of thinking of the world to a Muslim way of thinking of the world, but you actually have a kind of a fusion of these. This happens to be where my field of study is, but somebody looked at my ijazah tinggi, my PhD certificate from the University of Malaya, which is written in Arabic-influenced Malay, and my doctorate is a doctor falsafa, okay, which is the Arabic word for philosophy. Well, it's obviously not an indigenous Arabic word. It was learned from the Arabs bumping up against the Greeks, as they also picked up Neoplatonism and seven levels and all of this, which is central to Sufi mysticism. So that kind of fusion, Taylor says now, that naivete, the naivete in which the only imaginable world is a world with the transcendent, is over. It is unavailable to either believers or non-believers. You can believe or not believe, but you cannot naively believe. And for that matter, you can't naively not believe. Okay. Now, this kind of secularism, and I won't go through the 800 pages of arguments that he marshals for it, he says, has a couple of kinds of changes that are related to the human person, and these are important to us. And by the way, extremely observable. I have a colleague from Romania, which is an area that's outside the secular age, and she and I talk about these self-concepts all the time, or we could talk about the way I encountered Christianity in Malaysia. Prior to the secular age, the self was porous, meaning that through myself there poured the transcendent, the invisible world, the spiritual. It was as much a part of me as my heart and lungs are. Okay? And because myself is porous to this other world, then I have all kinds of worries about demons and spirits and cosmic forces because they act on me directly. Okay? Myself is interpenetrated by both sacred and secular time. So that myself is fully engaged in not merely the workaday world of getting up in the morning and farming or whatever, but myself is also fully engaged in the sacred cycles of whatever religion I'm part of. Okay? And of course, the porous self is vulnerable to many influences that cannot be easily resisted or can be resisted only by marshaling other external spiritual powers. Right? So if if you perform an exorcism in Malaysia, which is something I've been called upon to do, I got no training on that at Perkins, I have to tell you. Somehow it's not on the curriculum of modern seminary. But of course, the means by which you perform an exorcism is not to inform the person that they are actually silly and naive and that there's no such thing as demons. The way in which you perform the exorcism is calling loudly on another spirit, a bigger, more powerful spirit, the Spirit of Christ, to kick the other demon out. Right? And in the world in which this person lives, that's perfectly acceptable. And I might add, it works. Way better than going to a psychiatric hospital. It actually functions. Okay? So, that's this porous self. The porous self, depending on the exact religion and background, but the porous self is completely full of these other spiritual influences. Now, what happens with the rise of modernity in the Enlightenment is the rise of what Charles Taylor calls the buffered self. The buffered self has a firm sense of the boundary between me and the rest of the world, including the spiritual world. There's me. I have a mind. My mind thinks about the outside world, but, by the way, I control and I guard the boundary between me and it. I'm in charge of it. I don't have to let anything from out there into me. I'm not porous at all. I'm buffered. And that makes a big difference in the way that we think about things. Okay? So, for example, in Malaysia, I regularly had my students report to me that they had had a dream in which one of the particular Hindu deities, these were Christian students, by the way, in which a particular Hindu deity had approached them in the dream and tempted them in some way. If it was a male student, usually some sort of sexual temptation. Okay? And they had absolutely no doubt that they had met this Hindu deity in their dream. Now, the average American, male, let us say, waking up from such a dream, okay, would immediately say, God, I'll never eat pizza again like that. Right? We've already assumed that there was no deity, that this is a product of natural processes which our mind can control and understand. Right? And that's this buffering. My mind is always between me and even the world of the spirit, even the transcendent world. Okay? The buffered self is subject only to ordinary time and accepts sacred times only by invitation. So I don't imagine that anything really is happening on Christmas Day unless what I allow to happen. Right? My buffering says that Christmas Day is a holiday, and you know this, I mean, this happens in churches all the time. The church is my world. We constantly remind our students that Christmas is actually a pagan holiday, and it was probably the transposition of Mithras, right? Okay, nobody in the medieval world imagined that. They imagined that as the sacred cycle progressed, they were coming closer and closer to the birth of Jesus, right? Which would come around. And in the Hindu world, the same thing. As you walk toward the great temple at Tivoli, you are coming closer to the place where Rama actually touched the earth. Right? And you want to go there because there's physical space in between you, but no spiritual space. There's no buffering. I can get closer to that. So, going on, this buffered self is not merely subtracting naive or irrational beliefs around us. It's not merely that science pushes out beliefs that are naive or irrational. Okay? It is, in fact, building a barrier of rational analysis that will exclude the possibility of being affected by anything that's beyond our control. My rational analysis will bring every experience that I have into my own control. None of it will be external to me. It will all be something that I control through my mind. You can't make me change that. Right? Now, I'm not saying that buffered individuals don't occasionally have moments of insight that they regard as somehow breaking through this buffered self. But nonetheless, the great trend of the buffered self is that it completely protects itself from being porous to any outside influence, including, by the way, something like love of other human beings. Love becomes something I think about, rationalize about. I, in fact, can build up an entire website that's based on a series of 320 questions that if I ask them to you, then a computer will tell me that I should love you and we will fall in love. The process is entirely controllable, right? And by the way, if I decide in my buffered self that I'm no longer in love, then we can end it. Okay. The buffered self can therefore form the ambition of disengaging from anything beyond the boundary and giving its own autonomous order to its life. And this absence of fear of the outside telling me who I am is not only something that can be enjoyed, but very importantly, it becomes the opportunity for self-control and self-direction. I can feel like I'm morally in charge of my own life now. I'm the one making the decisions, not some sort of invisible spirits acting through me. And by the way, even though I may come to the point where, okay, I don't believe in the invisible spirits acting through me, but now I can go even further. I can deconstruct the social basis of my behavior. I can look for the psychological roots of my behavior, right? Through a process of rationalization, I can actually gain complete control of myself. And if that doesn't work, because there is actually a physical deformity in the brain, some kind of chemical imbalance, I can then go to drugs. And I can bring it all under control, hopefully. Now, does everybody like that kind of sense of absolute self-control and autonomy? No, but none of us can ignore the possibility that we would have it, right? We don't have to enjoy it. I have a very good friend from Austria. She occasionally comes to Dallas, although more and more rarely. By an odd fluke of fate, she receives a monthly very good pension that's deposited into a U.S. bank account, and so she's never going to starve, but she is paranoid schizophrenic, and she won't take her meds. And she won't take her meds because when she's off the meds, she is flipping brilliant. She knows everything in the world as clear as day. She sees every conspiracy. She writes me in 4 different languages in which she's fluent. She calls me Pablo. She believes that I consult regularly with President Obama. Or alternately, that I'm trying to kill her. And sometimes, you know, it crosses my mind. I mean, it's difficult to be accused of poisoning someone over and over and over, you know, and get this thing. So this is funny in a kind of a sick way, but I'm still going to tell the joke because it's just too good. Part of the pension plan of which she's a beneficiary is that she's a member of the Kaiser Permanente HMO thing. And so when she imagined that she was being poisoned, she checked herself into one in California, and they wrote up a quick evaluation of her and gave it to her and released her because she wasn't dangerous. And in the evaluation, it says suspected paranoid schizophrenia. And she sent this to me as evidence that they were out to get her. I'm not making this up. Okay. But even a person like that who really actually, for very deep personal reasons and psychological reasons, understandably cannot get their act together, I have also seen her when she's regularly taking her lithium. And she is dull, but she's also sane, right? She can hold a job. She can do work, that sort of thing. So she has this sort of Pyrrhic choice, but she is under control of herself, right? Now, so I've mentioned the porous self of pre-modernity and the buffered self of modernity. Another thing that Taylor talks about is what he calls the difference between the transcendent frame and the immanent frame. I am going to get to the topic of the talk in a minute, by the way. The transcendent frame, according to Taylor, is where all of life is in a framework that references God and God's ordering of creation. And not to mention God and God's ordering of creation, but all of the extra-human and superhuman forces that are opposed to God's order and God's creation, the forces of chaos and evil, the force of Satan. All of that is part of the transcendent frame, okay? And so, in fact, in this world, this pre-modern world, ordinary time, which is the time that we mostly experience every day, is constantly interpenetrated with the sacred times, the higher times. And so you not only have the clockwork of the sun and the moon and the stars, you have the clockwork of the moral universe, right? There's the slow wheel of karma going around, not just the earth revolving around the sun or the sun around the earth, however you conceptualize it. In this transcendent frame, all of my life is interpenetrated by the divine in judgment and in other ways. And I feel it. I feel it coming. As Christmas approaches and approaches, I feel Christmas coming. As Easter approaches, I feel it coming. I feel, by the way, and Taylor makes a lot of this, and he does a very brilliant study on this, I feel at certain times that this vast struggle, of course, between chaos and moral order is coming out. It's breaking into my time. And I have to let it do that, right? I have to let it do it. When do I do it? At Carnival. Just prior to Lent. Lent's the business of tamping it down and getting it back under control. Now, I have to say, here in the U.S., we're so boring with this season. We don't know what to do. We have our little one-day Halloween where we let the ghosts out. That's pitiful. It's pitiful. I loved Austria for this because the season of Carnival, the season of the outbreaking of chaos, goes from Epiphany to the first day of Lent. It's also the ball season, right? It's great to live in a city that has a ball season, you know? We went to balls. I can't believe this. I own 3 tuxedos now, and I bought them all used at Goodwill. Only in Austrian Goodwill can you buy tuxedos used, right? But that's Carnival. That's what Carnival's about. Chaos breaks loose for a while. Chaos begins to interpenetrate our lives. Funny things happen. But you have to let that happen, by the way, because it's part of what it means to be a real human being. You also have chaotic forces in you, and they have to express themselves, right? In Austria, they did some fun things with this. My favorite was just before Christmas, where you have a little mini carnival, and on a particular day, all of the demons that are called Krampus come out, and St. Nicholas, you remember him, St. Nicholas whips them through the streets. And they, I'm not joking, they do this. Young men, buff young men, put on costumes that make them look like demons, and they run around the streets pinching people, especially women, while a guy in a bishop's outfit with a whip sort of drives them forward. Big fun for everybody. Big fun for everybody. The kids love it. Tourists, a little scary. Okay. So that's the transcendent frame. We're interpenetrated. I took some, this is like, it's around December 16th, I think. I took some friends out to go down to the main street, and all of a sudden we come around the corner, and here's these 12 or 13 guys really dressed like demons with huge horns and stuff like this running around pinching people. And back in the background, there's this very stately guy with a bishop sort of whipping him like this. And my friend just go, what the hell? Because one of them runs up and pinches her. And she goes, wait, this is public. Where are the police? Okay. Because we know the police can't do anything about this sort of thing. Right? The police can't control demons. You got to get St. Nicholas out for that. Okay? That's the transcendent frame. And as this festival suggests in Carnival and other things, we have cultural memories of it. We have cultural memories of it. But Taylor would maintain they're mere memories. We don't feel it anymore. That he would say, this is why we go to horror movies. This is why we worry about the zombie apocalypse. It's a desperate attempt to just feel a little of that. Just feel a little of what we used to be able to feel all the time. That there was something beyond and through penetrating us so that we're not just stuck in our little bodies with our intellectual buffers. Right? Now, what replaces that, according to Taylor, is the immanent frame. And the immanent frame, he says, from the 17th century onward, is a new possibility that gradually arrives in which social life is secular and that's all there is. There's no social life that is transcendent at all. Secular, originally in European languages, refers to profane or ordinary time in contradistinction between sacred times, okay? And eventually the word secular comes to be understood that we just live in ordinary time. There is no kairos. There's no sacred time that interpenetrates us. And the ideas arise great generally in concert with each other. One is that secular time is simply irrelevant. It's not a denial of it. It's just not relevant to anything we do every day of the life. We can live without sacred time. It can go and wheel off its thing in the universe. But we can live a secular life in ordinary time and we don't need to reference it. Or, in its more extreme form, it just isn't there. It's just, it's our imaginations. Life is entirely immanent and secular. And so only, by the way, since social life becomes entirely immanent, lived entirely in a social space without reference to transcendent time, then the only place for transcendent time to continue to dwell is in private belief and faith. It becomes privatized. If you can live that way, fine. But don't impose it on everybody else. And we see the gradual progression of this. It lurches forward in some ways other than others. In the United States, it's by far the most advanced. We have no sacred holidays anymore. Everybody must work every day. I know this. My son and daughter-in-law work in retail. We'll never see them for Christmas, because they're lucky if they get Christmas Day off. And that won't happen much longer, I guarantee. We're not very many years away from where every day will be a shopping day. We will have no more sacred time in this country. Now, you can like that or hate it. It's just what it is. Okay? Social life in the immanent frame has two important changes. One, it brings a new conception of what is good in the social order. A goodness that has to be taken away from traditional transcendent moral ideas of goodness. So that the idea develops that the good is where there is mutual benefit. What is good for this worldly thriving? So it's all, the good is immanent. It's what's good for us. There's no more big rules. And they're the rules we make. Right? And because people go on believing in the transcendent, despite the fact that we live in this immanent frame, it is necessary, and here we're getting to public theology, for churches to somehow, or Christian organizations or religious organizations in general, to have a place in the social order. But increasingly for Christians, and we'll talk about Christians exclusively now, although it's the same is true of Judaism, for Christians to have a meaningful place in the social order, they have to take their Christian concerns and place them entirely in this worldly terms of goals and values. So what are you going to do? You're going to run food banks. You're going to work for peace. You're going to work for civil rights. You're going to work for women's rights against sexual harassment. But not one of these concerns, which now dominate by far and away, dominate the Christian churches in the United States, not one of these concerns is particularly religious or comes particularly from the transcendent. They are concerns that arise out of society thinking about its own self. Now, there will be Christians, and there are Christians, who pretend that they are, that we can have no morality without religious revelation. But I hope that all of us in this room realize that that's just nonsensical. The canons of morality were spelled out by Aristotle long before the time of Jesus Christ or the revelation of Moses. Human societies have not had the Ten Commandments to know that you shouldn't kill people or steal their wives or covet their goods. There was never a necessity for revelation for that. That could be reasoned out quite independently, and it has been. Okay? The key thing here being not that it's possible to reason it out independently, but at the very least that we think we're doing that, and that is the only kind of argument that we accept in the public square. You can't say revelation. You can't say God says this is the right way. Not in our society, for sure, right? So even something like the idea, which originates in religious revelation, or at least it originates in the Catholic Church's understanding of that, which is that human life begins at the meeting of the sperm and an egg, when it is argued in a public setting, it's not argued as religious revelation. It's argued as some kind of scientific fact. Right? Because we live in the immanent frame. Now, this binary of transcendent and immanent frames undergoes a further mutation via the denial of the transcendent into a dyad in which basically what is real is what is secular and what is imaginary or just a matter of belief or faith is transcendent. And then it's going to be only one step from that to the idea that the transcendent is denied altogether, that it's just unnecessary. And secular and religious become opposed not in terms of scientific and rational versus matters of faith and belief. They become opposed as what is true and what is false, what is right and what is wrong. Now, that may sound extreme because in American culture a lot of this is papered over right now. But believe me, you don't have to read very far into the pages of Scientific American, one of the few magazines I subscribe to, along with sailing magazines, I'm afraid that in my 30 years or 40 years of ministry, I just don't find the typical religious magazines all that useful. But Scientific American's good, and yet on its pages, what you can read is exactly this, and especially in the ads. Not merely the assertion that religious belief in the transcendent ought to be privatized, but the assertion that it is just bullshit that needs to be driven out of the society altogether. It has no place among us. Culturally, it's odd. Europe is culturally Christian and culturally religious when I lived there for 7 years. And so nobody has that sense because you can't drive out your indigenous culture, right? But effectively, it's that way. We don't talk about it. In Austria, we never talked about religion. The most shocking thing I ever heard when I came to the U.S. was my second day here, and I accidentally tried to pay for groceries with a euro, and the woman at the counter said, "We don't take that foreign currency." And I sort of apologetically said, "Oh, I've been living in Austria." And she goes, "Oh, are you new here?" And I said, "Yes." And she goes, "Well, have you found a church home yet, honey?" I just about fell over. If you ask that question to someone in Austria, it would be like asking about their sexual habits. You know? I mean, no way. What do you mean? Have you found your church home yet? What is the next thing you're going to ask me? Do I fool around with sheep? I mean, this is, you know, because Austria has become a completely secular society in this sense. We're really, and I'm telling you the honest truth, I was pastor of a church there. I had workmen who would not go through the front door of my church. They did not think that religion was a neutral fact of privatization. They regarded it as something loathsome and bad. They just assumed not associate. Right? We're not down that road in America. We're far from that road. Right? But it's there in the background. So, in this situation, and we'll now look at the standpoint of a Christian church, how do you remain relevant? How do you remain socially relevant? When the basis of your social thought, which is transcendence, is no longer an acceptable topic of public conversation, how do you remain relevant? Well, the answer that developed in the beginning of the 70s and 80s was something called, but Max Stackhouse, by the way, if you want to know the theologian who coined the term first, was something called public theology. An attempt to speak to public issues in a way that was credible and understandable to non-Christians. In other words, to speak about public issues in the public space in a way that would be credible to people who did not share your basic Christian beliefs. That was public theology. Okay? And there's books and books on it. And honestly speaking, I really hadn't heard that much about it until I moved here, because I always assumed that's all we did. I thought that's what Christian theology was trying to speak sensibly to people who didn't share your beliefs, but apparently it's a special field. So I'll just read you a definition here. Public theologians seek to communicate by means that are intelligible and assayable to all how Christian beliefs and practices bear, both descriptively and prescriptively, on public life and the common good, and in doing so, possibly persuade and move to action both Christians and non-Christians. Breitenberg, 2003. Quoted in Alain Graham. That's public theology. That's that effort. Now, public theology is born in the waning days of modernity and in the rising days of postmodernity. And it's born in the waning days of a society that could be regarded as secular, and in the birthing days of the society we live in now, which is increasingly characterized as post-secular. But to give you a taste of what post-secular means, I'm going to tell you a story, because that's what I do. Okay. So, about 8 months ago, I was the moderator of an interreligious dialogue between an imam, a priest, and a rabbi. And this is not a bad joke, okay? And by the way, we're talking about an Orthodox imam, that is to say an imam who is an Orthodox Muslim, he comes from outside the United States, nothing fancy about his belief, an Orthodox rabbi, not a Reformed rabbi, not a conservative rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, and an Orthodox evangelical pastor. So three people who are in the center of the mainstream of their own theological world. And they decided, not me, I warned them, they decided that they would take on the issue of gender, sexuality, and homosexuality, and would have a dialogue about it. Okay, I could see that there was trouble coming. Three white male religious leaders talking about sexuality and homosexuality and gender. Can you see the problem? Okay, but they couldn't see the problem. That's important to realize. So they each gave their own little spiel. They each got 20 minutes to ask each other some questions. My job is then to collect the written questions from the audience, throw out all the crazy ones, and ask the good ones. Well, all I got was crazy ones. Okay. Because all three, I mean, really, everything was scrawled in big handwriting. And it began with, how dare you? Okay. Because all three of these scholars, three different religions, agreed on everything. God created males and females differently. God intended males to be married to females and to create children. Whatever your sexual impulses are, and they all three used a similar illustration that was deeply offensive, which is that your sexuality is just like your desire to eat pork or shrimp. It's wrong, and you've just got to get over it, right? Okay. I mean, I listen, when the rabbi started on the desire to eat shrimp, and then the imam follows up with the desire to eat pork, I'm just looking out at the crowd, and steam is rising up, you know, smoke is coming up out of there. I said, this is not going to end well. Okay. It didn't end well. Because despite the fact that the three of them totally agreed on everything, the audience at this conservative synagogue, which is where we were, so it was mostly conservative Jews, the audience at the conservative synagogue completely disagreed. For the audience, gender is a biological incidental. It's a framework with which in which any individual determines their own personhood and expresses his or her own sexuality. And by the way, if your sense of sexuality doesn't match your gender, that can be changed, right? And that's perfectly legitimate. Neither God nor God's representatives are allowed to be part of that personal conversation. In other words, the basic standpoint of the audience was none of these three guys talking had any right to talk about this. They have no role. They have no right to tell me what my gender is. They have no right to tell me how to express my sexuality. They have no right to tell me how I should be married. That is my business. And it belongs in an imminent frame. Now, what did all three of them think? Well, all three of them said, we speak for God. Yeah. Of course we have a right to talk about this. Now, I'm going to talk about some of the specific problems of that conversation in just a minute. But you get the sense. Boy, I was there like 2.5 hours talking to people going, really, I didn't plan this. Let me try to help you explain that you sitting out there are modern people and these three guys sitting up here have been imported from the 16th century. We're having a cross-cultural moment. You know what I mean? Okay? I mean, I teach cultural intelligence. I teach people to respect cross-cultural interactions. And I was trying to explain that that's what we had going on. That this wasn't three evil guys versus good guys. This was a different culture that you're not used to ever talking to or being part of has come in. Right? Okay? Now, how could that conversation happen in 2014, in this case in Richardson, Texas? Okay? Because we don't live in a secular age anymore. We live in the age of post-secularity. And what that means is that the public space, the social space, is inhabited by whole communities that are not secular in the sense that Charles Taylor means. They are not secular in the sense that they can no longer naively believe in a porous self of the transcendent. These communities are made up of porous selves who sense the transcendent immediately. They aren't buffered. God speaks to them, and through them, and with them. And what that means for the rest of us is that an almost 200-year treaty that said how we would speak in public spaces about important things is no longer relevant. Because we don't live in a secular age, we live in a post-secular age. And that creates some problems. Now, to say a little bit more about this post-secular age, one of the things that Charles Taylor is interested in is how do you get to post-secularity quite apart from immigrant cultures, right? So with In the case of the Orthodox rabbi, he's Israeli. He migrated to Israel a long time ago. He lives in an Orthodox Israeli community, and it is still a community infused with pre-modern ideas. Okay, so when he comes to the U.S., he really is moving from one cultural world, the world of this rabbinical world, to another world. The same is true of the imam. The imam himself is an immigrant. He serves a largely immigrant mosque. Okay, in fact, many of his own young people were just sitting out there going, "Oh, this is bad," you know, because they live in the modern world and they know that he doesn't, right? But the preacher is still different. Right? This is an American guy trained at a mainline Protestant Christian school in Fort Worth, Texas, and not a Baptist school. Right? So where does that come from? So Taylor says this. He says, one of the things that happens in the modern era, in the secular age, is the incredible rise of individual expressionism and the cult of authenticity, of being my authentic self. Now, that's the other big book he wrote. Okay? And authenticity of the human self had previously, in pre-modern society, been located within the transcendent framework. To be me, I needed to be the me that God made me. Right? So I had to go and get in touch with God to know who I am. But once you put aside the transcendent framework, then the self locates itself in the human spirit. And the spirit is the right word here, the human spirit. A spirit of freedom, a spirit of self-expression, of personal evolution. So that spirituality turns out to be immanent, not transcendent. Because the spirit, which your spirit is in touch with, is not a transcendent God, it's the human spirit. By the way, fabulous Scottish pop singer, Amy MacDonald. I think she'll be short-lived. I've got two of her albums. I love them. Anyway, Amy MacDonald actually has a song called Human Spirit. It's a paean to the human spirit. Okay? So that, in fact, out of this search for human authenticity, there arise a vast number of new paths in which I seek for my spirit within this human spirit of freedom and self-expression and stuff to know who I am. And so I'm trying to find out where I sit within the immanent frame within which the human spirit is located. Maybe thinking of something transcendent and objective, but maybe not. Because after all, namaste, I greet the God in you. You greet the God in me. Right? That's the spirit. Taylor says that this results in what he calls a spiritual supernova. I'll quote, "And along with this and integral to it, there arises in Western societies a generalized culture of authenticity or expressive individualism in which people are encouraged to find their own way, to discover their own fulfillment, to, quote, do their own thing." He puts it in quotes because he doesn't like it. It's only the last 100 pages of the book when you realize that Charles Taylor, for all his brilliant social science, is actually a kind of a conservative French Catholic. Okay, he's Canadian, he's not French. Anyway, same thing. Okay.
From Quebec,
yes. The ethic of authenticity originates in the Romantic period, but has utterly penetrated popular culture in recent decades, certainly since the time of World War II, if not even more closely to the present. This turn has plainly altered the shape of secularity, mainly by shifting the place of the spiritual in human life, at least as it's lived by many, many people. The connection between pursuing a moral or spiritual path and belonging to larger ensembles, the state or the church or denomination, has been delusened, if not dissolved. So I no longer pursue my path within a fixed sort of path. I'm really on my own. And the result is a kind of a nova effect that has been intensified. So we're living in a spiritual supernova, a kind of galloping pluralism on a spiritual plane in which everybody creates their own religion. Time Magazine's actually done an article on this. I find it all the time among my students at Perkins School of Theology. It's driving the church people nuts that their incoming ministers are creating their own religion, not being faithful to the you know, we actually now, it used to be our students knew what the Apostles' Creed was. Now we have to coach them on that before they do their ordination exam. And then once they're finished, do they think, no, they're on their own. Okay? Now, This post-secular age, this galloping supernova of pluralistic spiritualities, which are themselves immanent because they're not really thinking about the transcendent, they're thinking about the human spirit. This represents the emergence of a new kind of public square in which religion is newly resurgent. Classical pre-modern religion is newly resurgent, right? Through immigration and other forces, okay? And yet, the legitimacy of religion as a form of public reason continues to be hotly contested. The political tension at the heart of post-secular is this. While the resurgence of religion is regarded by many as prompting a much-needed moral rejuvenation of secular society, for others, this new eruption of faith continues to represent a dangerous breach in the neutrality of the public sphere. We are moving in uncharted waters. How does a liberal pluralist democracy square that particular circle? How does this new dispensation of the sacred and the secular set up new conventions of identity, citizenship, governance, and public discourse about the common good? That's what the Texas legislature was actually debating today. Because although the law is that they were trying to pass talks about banning foreign laws from U.S. courts, we all know that foreign laws stood for primarily Sharia law and secondarily Jewish halakha and tertiarily Hindu or any other group that has their own set of moral commands, right? But one could easily argue that the Ten Commandments is moral law. I don't think the Texas legislators realized that they were legislating the Ten Commandments out of the state, given all the effort they made to keep the Ten Commandments in the courts, but still. I don't expect rationality down there, honestly. Or intelligence. Yeah, or intelligence. So here's a few of the issues that come up in this. One that emerged in our little dialogue is the issue of representation. Who represents who? Who belongs in a public dialogue about public life on certain issues? Within a secular age, it became obvious, or it seemed to be obvious, that for a woman's point of view to be represented, you had to have a woman, because it's a subjective internal point of view. For an African-American point of view to be represented, you had to have an African-American. For a Latino point of view to be represented, you had to have a Latino. For a Muslim point of view, a Muslim, right? Because nobody in this secular understanding can rise out of their identity and objectively speak on behalf of anybody else. That was one thing that infuriated our group at the dialogue. How can three men speak meaningfully about women? And the three men would say, God's law is objective and neutral. I'm not speaking on behalf of my masculinity, I'm speaking on behalf of God, and God's neutral. Right? The source of your social order. Where does it arise and how does it progress towards its goals? Is the source of your social order from a revealed order that God gives us and says that this is the way it is, men and women are created to procreate, etc. We don't have any Adam and Steve, whatever. Or is the source of your social order a contract between the members of the society itself, which can change according to circumstance? Right? Now, by the way, sorry I've been talking all day. I would just add, one of the things that I often have to deal with in public debate about this is actually reading, not the Declaration of Independence, but the U.S. Constitution. I commend it heartily to you because apparently most of our legislators haven't read it. But you will note that the U.S. Constitution makes no reference to divine law or the transcendent. It begins with the words, we the people. So you understand exactly who is the source of morality and law and who can change it if they want to. Right? It is a totally secular document, and it's located thoroughly in the imminent frame of the secular age. Okay? But there remains an extremely strong force in American society and other societies in the world which believe that a totally imminent social order based entirely on free human beings discoursing about their needs is deeply problematic because it has no touchstone in the divine. Now, what is the source and end of human personhood? Right? This sort of personal authenticity thing says the source and the end of human personhood is me. I know who I am, or I should be discovering who I am, and when I end being me, meaning my physical body dies, it'll be over. I will have been myself until I quit being myself. But there's nobody else who can make me me. Only me. Right? And so it's given, I'm not going to survive after the death of my body because that's what holds the me together. And finally, the big question, who defines what is good? Who defines the good? Is it us talking to each other about what's good? Or do we make an appeal to the transcendent, tell us what is good? Okay. Let's take these a little bit. One, representation. Who then belongs in public dialogue about public life? All these people assaulted me and said, you should have had a woman, you should have had a gay man. You can't even have a discussion unless the parties being talked about are represented. Okay? By the way, my church, at least the Methodist Church, is totally bought into this. We can't talk about anything unless we have 42 different people there. Okay? I'm serious. Because you have to have a youth representative, a younger youth representative, older youth representative, young adult representative, a midlife representative, all male and female both, and of all possible ethnic groups. Okay? Then you have to have a person who is differently abled. You need to have at least one gay person, male and female. You need a transgendered person. Because we believe that you can't have any serious conversation unless everybody's represented. Okay? There's other people who would say, no, a group of entirely middle-aged white men with limited experience can make decisions for the entirety of society without any problem.
Okay. And it doesn't work.
Well, it hasn't worked. I grant you it hasn't worked, but in theory, right? Okay? What is the source of the social order? I've already said God or God's law. Or is it free autonomous persons working out their own autonomous interests attempting self-fulfillment? The source and end of human personhood, is it God or is it me? Or maybe it's society. Maybe society makes us as persons and fits us to serve social purposes through processes of education and enculturation. And we should just go with that. Actually, there are, and China would be a good example, there are highly secularized cultures like Chinese society in mainland China today in which that's an acceptable answer. Society creates the individual for its own purposes, right? And by the way, there's many, many individuals who buy into that. They don't have any problem with that, okay? Who determines the good? God the Creator? The good is what God wants us to do? Do we have an evolutionary ethic? The biologist's name is escaping me now, who wrote a good article in the Atlantic Monthly titled, I Would Give My Life for One Brother, Two Cousins, or Four Second Cousins. Because that's enough people to have my whole genetic inheritance, right? So it's a purely genetic ethic. What's good is that I preserve my genome. Or what's good for us is that we preserve our genome, right? Or do we free individuals talking to each other decide what's good? Or maybe I personally will determine what's good for me. And the only limits to my ability to express or entertain that good will be the limits that you, ugly people, place on me by telling me I can't have a fourth drink before I drive. Right? But then you're limiting my good. Okay, I'm going to wrap up here because I know you want to ask questions. I've probably talked too long. What I've tried to describe is the conditions under which modern public debate is going on and the conditions under which what we call in the church public theology needs to transpire. They are conditions in which the long-standing, more than a century standing, secular agreement in which the transcendent would be excluded from public debate is now breaking down. It's breaking down because of both new religious communities who never bought into that to start with, but it's also breaking down because of the vast increase of personal spiritualities that one way or another make a claim about the individual's spiritual life as having authority that can be brought into the public square. Okay? And in some cases, projecting that into the transcendent. Right? To say my individual view of this is transcendent. If you expect that I would offer actually any solutions or anything like that, of course I have none. I can tell you it's an incredibly difficult time to try to be a public intellectual. Because I find that on one hand I'm dealing with people of a pre-modern ilk and I'm trying to explain to them that the social setting in which they're in is highly secularized, and I'm dealing with people of a secular mindset that actually can no longer even imagine the world of many of our American fellow citizens that's interpenetrated with the transcendent. And getting everybody to have a civil conversation is actually quite difficult. Although I will tell you, in interreligious dialogue, it happens more often than not. And I will tell you that the reason for that is that actually most human beings are pretty decent people if they're face-to-face. But give an email, a response to a blog, or Facebook, then we are just wicked. I write blogs, I never read the responses, because boy, all the little creepy crawler creatures come out of the dark for that. Okay, thank you, David.
Are you just talking about America, or did you see that in Austria, for example?
My experience in Austria and more generally reading in Europe is that this is true even more there. The Elaine Graham, who I quoted a little bit, actually does all of her analysis in England, and so I trust that she knows what she's talking about. I have to say that American constructions of this are quite different than European constructions, simply because there's very different ideas about the relationship between religion and culture. Austria, for example, does not de facto exclude religion from public life in the sense of religious institutions. So the Catholic Church, the Judaische Glaubensgemeinschaft, the Jewish community, the Muslim community, the Islamische Glaubensgemeinschaft, and the Protestant Church are constitutionally recognized public bodies. And so they have a right to be at the table to speak. But they're recognized as important cultural and social institutions, not because they speak for God. Right? So it's a little different construction. Here and then here, yeah.
Thank you for your talk. And as a longtime atheist,
yeah,
I appreciate it. It wasn't too painful, although I was raised Southern Baptist. Thank you for your talk. I have both an announcement and a question as to the First Amendment.
Yeah.
The Cato Institute, April 16th, will be at the Ritz-Carlton, mm-hmm. and Mr. Fleming Rose is going to be the luncheon speaker, and he was the publisher of Jyllands Posten, which is the Copenhagen newspaper that published the Mohammed cartoons, which led to the cartoon crisis.
Yeah.
There will be men with automatic weapons there to protect us. I heard him last month in Naples, same thing.
Yeah.
What about in this post-secular age, the First Amendment, mm-hmm. you being a fan of the Constitution, the right to offend, whereas in Europe, they have made it, they can put you in prison for saying that the Holocaust didn't happen.
Yeah.
So free speech is being rolled back, it's being interpreted as to not offend,
right.
versus the right to offend, if you comment on that.
Well, I'll leave Europe for just a second, of course. I think you've hit the heart of one of the most important things, and I would strongly say that you cannot have intelligent speech about religion unless you have a right to say things that are offensive about religious people and institutions. And the reason I say that is not because I'm in favor of offensive speech. It is because from the standpoint of faith, anything you say at all that questions a religious figure or speech could be taken as offense. Now, the place I experienced this very directly was in Malaysia. Although Malaysia has a constitutional right of freedom of speech, and thus far its courts have upheld it, okay, it has a sort of an Islamist fringe which has weaseled its way into the government. And that Islamist fringe basically says that if we as Muslims say that you as Christians are stupid, and you as Christians say you're wrong, we're not stupid, then because we were speaking religiously, you have offended our religion by questioning the truth of our statement that you're stupid. Right? So you can see how quickly you can go down the road where what is supposed to be the protection against offense actually is just a complete shutting down of all speech. And so, in fact, I think our U.S. courts are right to have interpreted the First Amendment to say that you can offend people, and you can offend them deeply. Because if we don't draw the line right there, then we're back somewhere else. We saw the pushback in Europe after the Charlie Hebdo things. I think most Europeans, in fact, realize that some of the direction they've gone in trying to be PC is problematic for the own maintenance of their freedom of religious speech. But yeah, I agree with that. And that's, I think it is a little bit different in Europe because they have different constructions. France would be the most extreme, other countries less extreme. Very problematic in Eastern Europe. In Eastern Europe and Russia, the Orthodox churches still have significant power with government officials, and therefore they can make it very hard on both religious minorities and atheists to speak freely. Yeah, does that help?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have two questions.
Sure.
What do you do with sheep?
Never mind.
The second question?
What is the nature of God in this individual transcendence? What's the definition of God, or is there a definition, or is there a nature of God, or is it just an abstract?
I would say there's no one answer to that.
Right.
Okay. I'm going to try to really simplify a complicated thing. That's what I do very well. It substitutes for knowledge. One way of looking at this is seeing that sort of all humans seeking after an eschatological purpose for my life is a search for God. So that I would tell you that even if you're an atheist, you're actually looking for God through your atheism. Okay? That's a kind of a condescending way of looking at things. I think people should represent themselves. But there are many people, and I meet them all the time, who fall into that framework. They don't want to define God, but they believe that whatever the word God means is out there at the end of their quest. Okay? And their quests are varied, but they, especially now, can draw a great deal of support and sympathy from the classical teaching of the subcontinent that we call Hinduism, which maintains that all legitimate human journeys are journeys towards God, but we don't need to name the God, right? There are others in which we have essentially individuals who come up to sort of a level of spiritual leadership by announcing that they have had in fact some sort of revelatory experience that gives them a particular insight into the divine, which that they can share with others, and then they gather followers around them. And those can be very big groups of followers. They can be very small groups of followers. And it happens that the classic Axial Age religions have billions of followers, but there are many smaller groups that center around an individual. Sometimes they don't last more than a generation. Most of them are in Portland. joke. Okay. But in a sense, all of these are ways in which this is constructed out of an individual immanent frame with an eye toward the transcendent, but not a recognition that it's here and present now. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. I think I'm favorably representing Charles Taylor. Yeah.
Dr. Hunt, yeah. I have a question for you, but a little introductory comments first.
Okay.
I gave a talk here about the neurological and anthropological basis for why the
brain
needs religion,
needs
rituals and belief and myths and that sort of thing. And so it's kind of wired in there, you know?
Yeah.
And then after the Enlightenment, science and, putting down the absolute teachings, the church, et cetera, the great thinkers thought, well, religion's going to go away. It's going to die and, dustbin of history. Well, in the most materialistic, scientific country in the world, the United States, religion is growing.
Yeah.
And even though we see atheists and agnostics growing, the evangelical churches are growing even more.
Mm-hmm.
And we see, fundamentalists of all religions in the world growing and becoming very vociferous. And some people think that this is kind of a reaction against secularism.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of a pushback. So what do you think is the future of this conflict, of this going back and forth? Do we really need religion? Is secularism going to win over in the short term and in the long term?
Yeah. Okay, well, that's a really good question. And so let's start with my accepting a premise I'm not sure I accept, but I think we'll start with the premise. And the premise is then that it is endemic to being human to be religious, that this is wired into us neurologically in one way or another, right? So let's accept that premise and then understand that the way in which we cope with that is our conscious processing is, it varies. So some people are going to say, okay, I've now outed the neurological source of my own religious impulse, and now I'm going to dismiss it consciously because I can now see it, I can make it go away. Others are not going to bother to become conscious of it, and they're just going to simply live it out, right? Charles Taylor, in the end of his book, or towards the end of his book, talks about the way in which a post-secular age is cross-pressured. And by cross-pressuring, what he means is that what appears to be the simple answer of secularity, which is to dismiss the transcendent from public and private life and to get on ahead, appears to not be as easy as it sounds. And so he says that people who pursue this path find themselves actually caught up in several different pressures. And some of those would be the simple question, and people answer it in varying degrees of success, what is the meaning of what I do? Right? I ask the question, what is the meaning of what I do? Some people are quite happy to say the meaning of what I do is right here every day I realize myself and I help others. And that'll someday end, and that's good. That's fine. That's all human life is meant to be. Okay? But others will say no. There's other pressures that come into there because I then have to justify why what I do for others is good, and that turns out to be a complicated question. Where do I get some sort of social support for it? So Taylor suggests that post-secularity is a result of these pressures that existed within the secular age. And he would say then that while we see a resurgence of certain religions, what we are actually seeing is a resurgence of an enormous plurality, this supernova of spirituality. Now, that's what he would say. I'm going to go a little bit deeper than his analysis and suggest this, that supernova of spirituality actually exists within religious communities, not merely among them. So that the ways of being a spiritual person in Richardson First United Methodist Church now are far more varied than they were 35 years ago. It may appear to be a single coherent organization, but in fact, the commitment is more to the community than a single path of Christian spirituality. Large churches in Dallas, I'm just going to speak for churches, have become essentially boutique churches. They have 8 or 9 different forms of worship. And if they're out on the liberal end of it, then they'll have a Shambhala Buddhist meditation as well. So that a church is no longer a home of a dogma, the church is a home of spiritual seekers of all sorts.
So will you predict 100 years from now what's going to be like?
You know, I suspect that the strongest and most coherent of the Axial Age religions, which have proved themselves enormously resilient, will be around and will be large. They will continually reform themselves in relationship to the societies they live in. Some of them will be incapable of that reform, or some branches of them will be incapable of that reform, and they will destroy themselves because they'll destroy their own social backing for this. I'll be honest. I don't think what's happening in the Middle East can go on forever because eventually it will simply become a region of such deep poverty and illiteracy and violence that it will be untenable to live there. There'll have to be a change. There was an effort to make that change once. It didn't work out, the Arab Spring. But I suggest that the next cycle will come sooner rather than later. Right? So I think that's kind of what's going to happen in the next 100 years. But you know, Robert Heinlein wrote some stuff about this. I think Dave and I both read Heinlein. And he sort of projects out some ideas about spirituality and religion, and I'm not sure they're entirely off base. So.
I think some of us want to keep coming back to Europe because we see that as kind of a canary in the mine shaft.
Yeah.
The United States, Londonistan, Paristan, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
In terms of what might happen there, what I think is already happening, and also in Israel, is that you have a sort of pastiche of parties going against the fundamentalist immigrant wave that would be a combination of sort of quasi-fascist or nationalist parties and libertarian
yeah.
parties, combined, ironically, with some of the religious former right
yeah.
of those nations themselves that don't want to get their version of religion overwhelmed by the fundamentalist
yeah.
Muslims. You can have that happening. With Tim Fortain, for example, with his party, you saw that as a kind of counter-reaction. You get this
yeah, Gerd Wilder, others,
Somali
yeah.
woman there that's very vocal in the Holland also. But maybe a happier, I don't know about happier, but a different possible version is that within those fundamentalist Muslims, there's an awful lot of corruption by technology and Western values anyway that's just under the surface, probably also in Southeast Europe and some of the more seemingly traditional societies. You'll have some woman going to church literally every day and hooking up on the weekend show, we say, with
yeah.
more than, just in a way you would just not expect in terms of consistency, yeah. shall we say. And in terms of those views of Europe, how would you see things? And then looking at that as a canary in the mine shaft thing for the United States, how would you yeah. predict things might look here in another 50 years, say?
Well, that's a good question about Europe and the U.S. And I think it's useful to start with some sort of factual data. Depending on the country that you're in, and Richard Jenkins has written a book on this, by the way, called God's Continent, I believe, about Europe. He's a sociologist of religion. One of the things he points out is that, of course, there are two factors at work in European demographics religiously. One factor is the slowing down of immigration. Many of the countries are closing their doors now to that. The other factor is that minority populations in Europe, and we'll just for a moment we'll talk about the Muslim populations of Arab and Arab-Pakistani descent, as these populations begin to become more entrenched and wealthy, then their birth rate's lower, they become more settled into the social structures, and it's less and less of their benefit to oppose them. Okay, a book across my desk here in the United States, very interesting book, and I've recently had this confirmed by my conversations with the imams of the major mosque in this area, all of whom are people I know pretty well, and that is that local mosques are having trouble keeping their young people. And we're beginning to have now, in religious circles, cross-religious studies, Jews, Muslims, and Christians talking together about how can we get our young people back in the religious institution. Because it isn't just former Christians that are turning into nuns. It's former Muslims and former Jews. It's probably worse than the Jewish community. It's at a crisis level in the Jewish community. So, there. And by the way, the Pew Charitable Trust predicts that the rate of Muslim population growth in the United States will, by the year 2030, have reached a stable point and be declining probably at 6% of the U.S. population. For all the same reasons that early immigrant populations blew up, leveled off, and began the same decline. All the same reasons. Now, an anecdote about this. I know, David, we've got to wrap it up. An anecdote about this. So I try to point out globalization trends to my friends. And one of the things that I point out is how in Islam itself morphs as it becomes a more universalized religion, is influenced by many different cultures. And so two evidences of this. One, there's a Malaysian boy band called Inteam. Four boys, it's the same with every boy band. And there's this Malaysian boy band sings Malaysian Muslim pop hits. They all dress very properly, Muslim with their hats. But if you begin to read the content of the music that they're singing, one, it's full of Christian images they all learned at Catholic schools. And two, it's very much within a pop groove. Okay? Now, more to the point, there's an internationally known Muslim artist named Mahir Zain. He is a Swede of Pakistani descent who sings Detroit R&B in English. Okay? A very, very groovy singer. But I can play five of his songs for my students, and they will think it's praise choruses until they heard the chorus that's Allahu Akbar. They can't distinguish the content of this Islamic music from their own Christian pop. And I have Malay music, pop, Malay Muslim pop music going back 30 years that I would say the same thing. We have radio stations here in Dallas that are already playing Naqshbandi and other Muslim mystic music. It's perfectly acceptable in our new imminent frame because all of it can become a way in which spiritualities are expressed. I'm in Europe a lot. I lived in Europe a long time. I never anywhere in Europe saw all of the frightening stuff that gets promoted by our media. And I lived in a neighborhood in Malaysia, in the 15th district of Vienna, 70% of the population was Turkish Muslim. And I never saw anybody, they were all members of sports clubs. You know? I mean, I just didn't see it. So I know, I'm not saying it's not there. I'm just saying our vision is very selective. I'm not too worried about Europe, and I'm not worried about the U.S. at all. Thanks.
Robert, hopefully you don't have a coffee mug that has a scene of the Agora in Athens and says featured speaker Dallas Philosophers Forum, but if you didn't, maybe you could.
Oh, Agora. You said Gomorrah.
Okay, no.